just in his mind, in his body. He could sense other experiences, as though he had just awakened, knowing he had dreamed but unable to recall the dream. This dream stuff called up knowledge that he knew he could not possess. Yet he did possess it. He could name some of the trees he smelled out there, but whose names were not in the library's records. This forbidden window was forbidden because it pierced an outer wall of the keep and could be opened. It was often open, as now, for ventilation. The window was reached from his room by climbing over a balcony rail and slipping through a storeroom air shaft. He had learned to do this without the slightest disturbance of rail or storeroom or shaft. Quite early, it had been made clear to him that those trained by the Bene Gesserit could read extremely small signs. He could read some of those signs himself, thanks to the teachings of Teg and Lucilla. Standing well back in the shadows of the upper hallway, Duncan focused on rolling slopes of forest, climbing to rocky pinnacles. He found the forest compelling. The pinnacles beyond it possessed a magical quality. It was easy to imagine that no human had ever touched that land. How good it would be to lose himself there, to be only his own person, without worrying that another person dwelled within him. A stranger there. With a sigh, Duncan turned away and returned to his room along his secret route. Only when he was back in the safety of his room did he allow himself to say that he had done it once more. No one would be punished for this venture. Punishment and pain, which hung like an aura around the places forbidden to him, only made Duncan exercise extreme caution when he broke the rules. He did not like to think of the pain Shuang Yu would cause him if she discovered him at a forbidden window. Even the worst pain, though, would not cause him to cry out, he told himself. He had never cried out even at her nastiest tricks. He merely stared back at her, hating her, but absorbing her lesson. To him, Shuang Yu's lesson was direct. Refine his ability to move unobserved, unseen, and unheard, leaving no spoor to betray his passage. In his room, Duncan sat on the edge of his cot and contemplated the blank wall in front of him. Once, when he had stared at that wall, an image had formed there, a young woman with light amber hair and sweetly rounded features. She looked out of the wall at him and smiled. Her lips moved without sound. Duncan already had learned lip reading, though, and he read the words clearly. Duncan, my sweet Duncan. Was that his mother, he wondered? His real mother? Even Golas had real mothers somewhere back there. Lost in the time behind the axolotl tanks, there had been a living woman who bore him and loved him. Yes, loved him because he was her child. If that face on the wall was his mother, how had her image found its way there? He could not identify the face, but he wanted it to be his mother. The experience frightened him, but fear did not prevent him from wanting to repeat it. Whoever that young woman was, her fleeting presence tantalized him. The stranger within him knew that young woman. He felt sure of this. Sometimes he wanted to be that stranger only for an instant, long enough to gather up all of those hidden memories, but he feared this desire. He would lose his real self, he thought, if the stranger entered his awareness. Would that be like death? He wondered. Duncan had seen death before he was 6. His guards had repelled intruders, and one of the guards was killed. 4 intruders died as well. Duncan had watched the 5 bodies brought into the keep. Flaccid muscles, arms dragging. Some essential thing was gone from them. Nothing remained to call up memories, self-memories or stranger memories. The 5 were taken somewhere deep within the keep. He heard a guard say later that the 4 intruders were loaded with shear. That was his first encounter with the idea of an Ixion probe.
An Ixion probe can raid the mind even of a dead person, Gyasa explained. Shear is a drug that protects you from the probe. Your cells will be totally dead before the drug effect is gone.
Adroit listening told Duncan the 4 intruders were being probed in other ways as well. These other ways were not explained to him, but he suspected this must be something secret to the Bene Gesserit. He thought of it as another hellish trick of the Reverend Mother's. They must animate the dead and extract information from the unwilling flesh. Duncan visualized depersonalized muscles performing at the will of a diabolical observer. The observer was always Shuang Yu. Such images filled Duncan's mind, despite every effort by his teachers to dispel foolishness invented by the ignorant. His teachers said these wild stories were valuable only to create fear of the Bene Gesserit among the uninitiated. Duncan refused to believe that he was of the initiated. Looking at a Reverend Mother, he always thought, "I'm not one of them." Lucilla was most persistent lately.
"Religion is a source of energy," she said. "You must recognize this energy. It can be directed for your own purposes." "Their purposes, not mine," he thought.
He imagined his own purposes and projected his own images of himself triumphant over the sisterhood, especially over Shuang Yu. Duncan felt that his imaginative projections were a subterranean reality that worked on him from that place where the stranger dwelled. But he learned to nod and give the appearance that he too found such religious credulity amusing. Lucilla recognized the dichotomy in him. She told Shuang Yu,
"He thinks mystical forces are to be feared and, if possible, avoided. As long as he persists in this belief, he cannot learn to use our most essential knowledge."
They met for what Shuang Yu called a regular assessment session, just the two of them in Shuang Yu's study. The time was shortly after their light supper. The sounds of the keep around them were those of transition, night patrols beginning, off-duty personnel enjoying one of their brief free time periods. Shuang Yu's study had not been completely insulated from such things, a deliberate contrivance of the sisterhood's renovators. The trained senses of a Reverend Mother could detect many things from the sounds around her. Shuang Yu felt more and more at a loss in these assessment sessions. It was increasingly obvious that Lucilla could not be won over to those opposing Terraza. Lucilla also was immune to a Reverend Mother's manipulative subterfuges. Most damnable of all, Lucilla and Teg between them were imparting highly volatile abilities to the Gola. Dangerous in the extreme. Adding to all of her other problems, Shuang Yu nurtured a growing respect for Lucilla.
"He thinks we use occult powers to practice our arts," Lucilla said. "How did he arrive at such a peculiar idea?"
Shuang Yu felt the disadvantage imposed by this question. Lucilla already knew this had been done to weaken the Gola. Lucilla was saying,
"Disobedience is a crime against our sisterhood."
"If he wants our knowledge, he will surely get it from you," Shuang Yu said.
No matter how dangerous in Shuang Yu's view, this was certainly a truth.
"His desire for knowledge is my best lever," Lucilla said, "but we both know that is not enough."
There was no reproof in Lucilla's tone, but Shuang Yu felt it nevertheless.
"Damn her, she's trying to win me over," Shuang Yu thought.
Several responses entered Shuang Yu's mind.
"I have not disobeyed my orders." Pah, a disgusting excuse. "The Gola has been treated according to standard Bene Gesserit training practices."
Inadequate and untrue. And this Gola was not a standard object of education. There were depths in him that could only be matched by a potential Reverend Mother, and that was the problem.
"I have made mistakes," Shuang Yu said.
There.
That was a double-pronged answer that another Reverend Mother could appreciate.
"You made no mistake when you damaged him," Lucilla said.
"But I failed to anticipate that another Reverend Mother might expose the flaws in him," Shuang Yu said.
"He wants our powers only to escape us," Lucilla said. "He's thinking, someday I'll know as much as they do, and then I'll run away."
When Shuang Yu did not respond, Lucilla said,
"That was clever. If he runs, we will have to hunt him down and destroy him ourselves."
Shuang Yu smiled.
"I will not make your mistake," Lucilla said. "I tell you openly what I know you would see anyway. I now understand why Terraza sent an imprinter to one so young."
Chuang Yu's smile vanished.
What are you doing?
I am bonding him to me the way we bond all of our acolytes to their teachers. I am treating him with candor and loyalty as one of our own.
But he's male.
So the spice agony will be denied him, but nothing else. He is, I think, responding.
And when the time comes for the ultimate stage of imprinting?
Chuang Yu asked.
Yes, that will be delicate. You think it will destroy him. That, of course, was your plan.
Lucilla, the sisterhood is not unanimous in following Taraz's designs for this Gola. Certainly you know this.
It was Chuang Yu's most powerful argument, and the fact that it had been reserved for this moment said much. The fears that they might produce another Kwisatz Haderach were deep-seated, and the dissension in the Bene Gesserit comparably powerful.
He is primitive genetic stock, and not bred to be a Kwisatz Haderach, Lucilla said.
But the Tlelaxu have interfered with his genetic inheritance.
Yes, at our orders. They have sped up his nerve and muscle responses.
Is that all they have done?
Chuang Yu asked.
You've seen the cell studies? Lucilla said.
If we could do as much as the Tlelaxu, we would not need them,
Chuang Yu said.
We would have our own axolotl tanks.
You think they have hidden something from us? Lucilla said.
They had him completely outside our observation for 9 months.
I have heard all of these arguments, Lucilla said.
Chuang Yu threw up her hands in a gesture of capitulation.
He's all yours then, Reverend Mother. And the consequences are on your head. But you will not remove me from this post no matter what you report to Chapter House.
Remove you? Certainly not. I don't want your faction sending someone unknown to us.
There is a limit to the insults I will take from you, Chuang Yu said.
And there's a limit to how much treachery Taraza will accept, Lucilla said.
If we get another Paul Atreides, or the gods forbid another tyrant, it will be Taraza's doing,
Chuang Yu said.
Tell her I said so.
Lucilla stood.
You may as well know that Taraza left entirely at my discretion how much melange I feed this Gola. I have already begun increasing his intake of the spice.
Chuang Yu pounded both fists on her desk.
Damn you all! You will destroy us yet!
The Tlelaxu secret must be in their sperm. Our tests prove that their sperm does not carry forward in a straight genetic fashion. Gaps occur. Every Tlelaxu we have examined has hidden his inner self from us. They are naturally immune to an Ixion probe. Secrecy at the deepest levels, that is their ultimate armor, and their ultimate weapon. Bene Gesserit Analysis, Archives Code BTXX441WOR. On a morning of Shiana's fourth year in Priestly Sanctuary, the reports of their spies brought a gleam of special interest to the Bene Gesserit watchers on Rakkas.
She was on the roof, you say?
The mother commander of the Rakkian keep asked. Tamerlane, the commander, had served previously on Gamu and knew more than most about what the sisterhood hoped to conjoin here. The spy's report had interrupted Tamerlane's breakfast of sifrut confit, laced with mélange. The messenger stood at ease beside the table while Tamerlane resumed eating as she reread the report.
On the roof, yes, Reverend Mother, the messenger said.
Tamerlane glanced up at the messenger, Kipuna, Arakian native acolyte being groomed for sensitive local duties. Swallowing back a mouthful of her confit, Tamerlane said,
Bring them back. Those were her exact words?
Kipuna nodded curtly. She understood the question. Had Shiana spoken with peremptory command? Tamerlane resumed scanning the report, looking for the sensitive signals. She was glad they had sent Kipuna herself. Tamerlane respected the abilities of this Rakkian woman. Kipuna had the soft round features and fuzzy hair common among much of the Rakkian priestly class, but there was no fuzzy brain under that hair.
Shiana was displeased, Kipuna said. The Thopter passed nearby the rooftop, and she saw the two manacled prisoners in it quite clearly. She knew they were being taken to death in the desert.
Tamerlane put down the report and smiled.
So she ordered the prisoners brought back to her. I find her choice of words fascinating.
Bring them back? Kipuna asked. That seems a simple enough order. How is it fascinating?
Tamerlane admired the directness of the acolyte's interest. Kipuna was not about to pass up a chance at learning how a real Reverend Mother's mind worked.
It was not that part of her performance that interested me, Tamerlane said.
She bent to the report, reading aloud.
You are servants unto Shaitan, not servants unto servants.
Tamerlane looked up at Kipuna.
You saw and heard all of this yourself?
Yes, Reverend Mother. It was judged important that I report to you personally, should you have other questions.
She still calls him Shaitan, Tamerlane said.
How that must gall them.
Of course, the tyrant himself said it. They will call me Shaitan.
I have seen the reports out of the horde found at Dar es Balat,
Kipuna said.
There was no delay in bringing back the two prisoners?
Tamerlane asked.
As quickly as a message could be transmitted to the Thopter, Reverend Mother, they were returned within minutes.
So they are watching her and listening all the time. Good.
Did Shiana give any sign that she knew the two prisoners? Did any message pass between them?
I am sure they were strangers to her, Reverend Mother. Two ordinary people of the lower orders, rather dirty and poorly clothed. They smelled of the unwashed from the perimeter hovels.
Shiana ordered the manacles removed, and then she spoke to this unwashed pair. Her exact words now. What did she say?
You are my people.
Lovely, lovely, Tamerlane said.
Shiana then ordered that these two be taken away, bathed, and given new clothes before being released.
Tell me in your own words what happened next.
She summoned Tuak, who came with three of his counselor attendants. It was almost an argument.
Memory trance, please, Tamerlane said. Replay the exchange for me.
Kipuna closed her eyes, breathed deeply, and fell into memory trance.
Then, Shiana says, I do not like it when you feed my people to Shaitan. Counselor Styros says, they are sacrificed to Shai Hulud. Shiana says, to Shaitan. Shiana stamps her foot in anger. Tuek says, enough, Styros, I will not hear more of this dissension. Shiana says, when will you learn?
Styros starts to speak, but Tuek silences him with a glare and says, we have learned, holy child.
Shiana says, I want enough,
Tamerlane said. The acolyte opened her eyes and waited silently. Presently, Tamerlane said,
return to your post, Kipuna. You have done very well indeed.
Thank you, Reverend Mother.
There will be consternation among the priests, Tamerlane said. Shiana's wish is their command because Tuek believes in her. They will stop using the worms as instruments of punishment.
The two prisoners, Kipuna said.
Yes, very observant of you.
The two prisoners will tell what happened to them. The story will be distorted. People will say that Shiana protects them from the priests.
Isn't that exactly what she's doing, Reverend Mother?
Ah, but consider the options open to the priests. They will increase their alternative forms of punishment, whippings and certain deprivations. While fear of Shaitan eases because of Shiana, fear of the priests will increase.
Within 2 months, Tamerlane's reports to Chapter House contained confirmation of her own words.
Short rations, especially short water rations, have become the dominant form of punishment,
Tamerlane reported.
Wild rumours have penetrated the farthest reaches of Rakkis, and soon will find lodging on many other planets as well.
Tamerlane considered the implications of her report with care. Many eyes would see it, including some not in sympathy with Terraza. Any Reverend Mother would be able to call up an image of what must be happening on Rakkis. Many on Rakkis had seen Shiana's arrival atop a wild worm from the desert. The priestly response of secrecy had been flawed from the beginning. Curiosity, unsatisfied, tended to create its own answers. Guesses were often more dangerous than facts. Previous reports had told of the children brought to play with Shiana. The much-garbled stories of such children were repeated with increasing distortions, and those distortions had been dutifully sent on to Chapter House. The two prisoners returned to the streets in their new finery only compounded the growing mythology. The sisterhood, artists in mythology, possessed on Rakis a ready-made energy to be subtly amplified and directed. "We have fed a wish-fulfillment belief into the populace," Tamerlane reported. She thought of the Bene Gesserit-originated phrases as she reread her latest report. "Shiana is the one we have long awaited." It was a simple enough statement that its meaning could be spread without unacceptable distortion. "The child of Shai Hulud comes to chastise the priests." That one had been a bit more complicated. A few priests died in dark alleys as a result of popular fervency. This had fed a new alertness into the core of priestly enforcers with predictable injustices inflicted upon the populace. Tamerlane thought of the priestly delegation that had waited upon Shiana as a result of turmoil among Tuek's counselors. Seven of them, led by Styros, had intruded upon Shiana's luncheon with a child from the streets. Knowing that this would happen, Tamerlane had been prepared, and a secret recording of the incident had been brought to her, the words audible, every expression visible, the thoughts quite apparent to a reverend mother's trained eye.
"We were sacrificing to Shai Hulud," Styros protested.
"Tuek told you not to argue with me about that," Shiana said.
How the priestesses smiled at the discomfiture of Styros and the other priests.
"But Shai Hulud," Styros began.
"Shaitan,"
Shiana corrected him, and her expression was easily read.
Did these stupid priests know nothing?
"But we have always thought you were wrong,"
Shiana stamped a foot. Styros feigned the need for instruction.
"Are we to believe that Shai Hulud, the divided god, is also Shaitan?"
What a complete fool he was, Tamerlane thought. Even a pubescent girl could confound him, as Shiana proceeded to do.
"Any child of the streets knows this almost as soon as she can walk,"
Shiana ranted.
Styros
spoke slyly.
"How do you know what is in the minds of street children?" "You are evil to doubt me,"
Shiana accused. It was an answer she had learned to use often, knowing it would get back to Tuek and cause trouble. Styros knew this only too well. He waited with downcast eyes while Shiana, speaking with heavy patience as one telling an old fable to a child, explained to him that either god or devil or both could inhabit the worm of the desert. Humans had only to accept this. It was not left to humans to decide such things. Styros had sent people into the desert for speaking such heresy. His expression, so carefully recorded for Bene Gesserit analysis, said such wild concepts were always springing up from the muck at the bottom of the Rakian heap. But now he had to contend with Tuek's insistence that Shiana spoke gospel truth. As she looked at the recording, Tamerlane thought the pot was boiling nicely. This she reported to Chapter House. Doubts flogged Styros. Doubts everywhere except among the populace in their devotion to Shiana. Spies close to Tuek said he was even beginning to doubt the wisdom of his decision to translate the historian locutor Dromund.
"Was Dromund right to doubt her?"
Tuek demanded of those around him.
"Impossible,"
the sycophants said. What else could they say? The high priest could make no mistake in such decisions. God would not allow it. Shiana clearly confounded him, though. She put the decisions of many previous high priests into a terrible limbo. Reinterpretation was being demanded on all sides. Styros kept pounding at Tuek.
"What do we really know about her?"
Tamerlane had a full account of the most recent such confrontation, Styros and Tuek alone debating far into the night, just the two of them, they thought, in Tuek's quarters, comfortably ensconced in rare blue chair dogs, mélange-laced confits close at hand. Tamerlane's holophoto record of the meeting showed a single yellow glow globe drifting on its suspensors close above the pair, the light dimmed to ease the strain on tired eyes.
"Perhaps that first time, leaving her in the desert with a thumper was not a good test,"
Styros said. It was a sly statement. Tuek was noted for not having an excessively complicated mind.
"Not a good test? Whatever do you mean?"
"God might wish us to perform other tests."
"You have seen her yourself, many times in the desert, talking to God."
"Yes,"
Styros almost pounced. Clearly it was the response he wanted.
If she can stand unharmed in the presence of God, perhaps she can teach others how this is accomplished.
You know this angers her when we suggest it.
Perhaps we have not approached the problem in quite the right way.
Styros, what if the child is right? We serve the divided God. I have been thinking long and earnestly upon this. Why would God divide? Is this not God's ultimate test?
The expression on Styros's face said this was exactly the kind of mental gymnastics his faction feared. He tried to divert the high priest, but Tuic was not to be shifted from a single-track plunge into metaphysics.
The ultimate test, Tuic insisted, to see the good in evil and the evil in good.
Styros's expression could only be described as consternation. Tuic was God's supreme anointed. No priest was allowed to doubt that. The thing that might now arise if Tuic went public with such a concept would shake the foundations of priestly authority. Clearly, Styros was asking himself if the time had not come to translate his high priest.
I would never suggest that I might debate such profound ideas with my high priest, Styros said, but perhaps I can offer a proposal that might resolve many doubts.
Propose, then,
Tuic said.
Subtle instruments could be introduced in her clothing. We might listen when she talks to...
Do you think God would not know what we did?
Such a thought never crossed my mind.
I will not order her taken into the desert, Tuic said.
But if it is her own idea to go?
Styros assumed his most ingratiating expression.
She has done this many times.
But not recently. She appears to have lost her need to consult with God.
Could we not offer suggestions to her? Styros asked.
Such as?
Shiana, when will you speak again with your father? Do you not long to stand once more in his presence?
That has more the sound of prodding than suggestion.
I am only proposing that...
This holy child is no simpleton. She talks to God, Styros. God might punish us sorely for such presumption.
Did God not put her here for us to study? Styros asked.
This was too close to the Dromund heresy for Tuic's liking. He sent a baleful stare at Styros.
What I mean, Styros said, is that surely God means us to learn from her.
Tuic himself had said this many times, never hearing in his own words a curious echo of Dromund's words.
She is not to be prodded and tested,
Tuic said.
Heaven forbid, Styros said. I will be the soul of holy caution, and everything I learn from the holy child will be reported to you immediately.
Tuic merely nodded. He had his own ways to be sure Styros spoke the truth. The subsequent sly proddings and testings were reported immediately to Chapter House by Tamerlane and her subordinates.
Shiana has a thoughtful look, Tamerlane reported.
Among the Reverend Mothers on Rakis and those to whom they reported, this thoughtful look had an obvious interpretation. Shiana's antecedents had been deduced long ago. Styros's intrusions were making the child homesick. Shiana kept a wise silence, but she clearly thought much about her life in a pioneer village. Despite all of the fears and perils, those obviously had been happy times for her. She would remember the laughter, poling the sand for its weather, hunting scorpions in the crannies of the village hovels, smelling out spice fragments in the dunes. From Shiana's repeated trips to the area, the sisterhood had made a reasonably accurate guess as to the location of the lost village and what had happened to it. Shiana often stared at one of Tuic's old maps on the wall of her quarters. As Tamerlane expected, one morning Shiana stabbed a finger at the place on the wall map where she had gone many times.
Take me there, Shiana commanded her attendants.
A thopter was summoned. While priests listened avidly in a thopter hovering far overhead, Shiana once more confronted her nemesis in the sand. Tamerlane and her advisers, tuned into the priestly circuits, observed just as avidly. Nothing even remotely suggesting a village remained on the dune-swept waste where Shiana ordered herself deposited. She used a thumper this time, however. Another of Styros's sly suggestions, accompanied by careful instructions on use of the ancient means to summon the divided god. a worm came. Tamerlane watched on her own relay projector, thinking the worm only a middling monster. Its length she estimated at about 50 meters. Shiana stood only about 3 meters in front of the gaping mouth. The huffing of the worm's interior fires was clearly audible to the observers.
"Will you tell me why you did it?" Shiana demanded.
She did not flinch from the worm's hot breath. Sand crackled beneath the monster, but she gave no sign that she heard.
"Answer me," Shiana commanded.
No voice came from the worm, but Shiana appeared to be listening, her head cocked to one side.
"Then go back where you came from," Shiana said.
She waved the worm away. Obediently, the worm backed off and returned beneath the sands. For days, while the Sisterhood spied upon them with glee, the priests debated that sparse encounter. Shiana could not be questioned lest she learn that she had been overheard. As before, she refused to discuss anything about her visits to the desert. Styros continued his sly prodding. The result was precisely what the Sisterhood expected. Without any warning, Shiana would awaken some days and say, "Today I will go into the desert." Sometimes she used a thumper. Sometimes she danced her summons. Far out on the sands beyond the sight of Keen or any other inhabited place, the worms came to her. Shiana alone in front of a worm talked to it while others listened. Tamerlane found the accumulated recordings fascinating as they passed through her hands on their way to Chapter House.
"I should hate you!"
What a turmoil that caused among the priests. Tuik wanted an open debate.
"Should all of us hate the divided god at the same time we love him?"
Styros barely shut off this suggestion with the argument that God's wishes had not been made clear. Shiana asked one of her gigantic visitors,
"Will you let me ride you again?"
When she approached, the worm retreated and would not let her mount. On another occasion she asked,
"Must I stay with the priests?"
This particular worm proved to be the target of many questions, and among them,
"Where do people go when you eat them? Why are people false to me? Should I punish the bad priests?"
Tamerlane laughed at that final question, thinking of the turmoil it would cause among Tuik's people. Her spies duly reported the dismay of the priests.
"How does he answer her?" Tuik asked. "Has anyone heard God respond?"
"Perhaps he speaks directly into her soul," a counselor ventured.
"That's it," Tuik leaped at this offering. "We must ask her what God tells her to do."
Shiana refused to be drawn into such discussions.
"She has a pretty fair assessment of her powers," Tamerlane reported. "She's not going into the desert very much now, despite Styros's proddings. As we might expect, the attraction has waned. Fear and elation will carry her just so far before paling. She has, however, learned an effective command. Go away."
The Sisterhood marked this as an important development. When even the divided god obeyed, no priest or priestess was about to question her authority to issue such a command.
"The priests are building towers in the desert," Tamerlane reported. "They want more secure places from which to observe Shiana when she does go out there."
The Sisterhood had anticipated this development and had even done some of its own prodding to speed up the projects. Each tower had its own wind trap, its own maintenance staff, its own water barrier, gardens, and other elements of civilization. Each was a small community spreading the established areas of Rakis farther and farther into the domain of the worms. Pioneer villages no longer were necessary, and Shiana got the credit for this development.
"She is our priestess," the populace said.
Tuik and his counselors spun on the point of a pin.
"Shaitan and Shaihulud in one body?"
Styros lived in daily fear that Tuik would announce the fact. Styros's advisers finally rejected the suggestion that Tuik be translated. Another suggestion that Priestess Shiana have a fatal accident was greeted with horror by all, even Styros finding it too great a venture.
"Even if we remove this thorn, God may visit us with an even more terrible intrusion," he said.
And he warned,
"The oldest books say that a little child shall lead us."
Styros was only the most recent among those who looked upon Shiana as something not quite mortal. It was observable that those around her, Khania included, had come to love Shiana. She was so ingenuous, so bright and responsive. Many observed that this growing affection for Shiana extended even to Tuek. For the people touched by this power, the sisterhood had an immediate recognition. The Bene Gesserit knew a label for this ancient effect: expanding worship. Tamerlane reported profound changes moving through Rakkas as people everywhere on the planet began praying to Shiana, instead of to Shaitan or even to Shai-Hulud. "They see that Shiana intercedes for the weakest people," Tamerlane reported. "It is a familiar pattern. All goes as ordered. When do you send the Gola?"
The outer surface of a balloon is always larger than the center of the damned thing. That's the whole point of the scattering. Bene Gesserit responds to an Ixian suggestion that new investigative probes be sent out among the lost ones. One of the Sisterhood's swifter lighters took Miles Teg up to the guild transport, circling Gamu. He did not like leaving the keep at this moment, but the priorities were obvious. He also had a gut reaction about this venture. In his 3 centuries of experience, Teg had learned to trust his gut reactions. Matters were not going well on Gamu. Every patrol, every report of remote sensors, the accounts of Patrin's spies in the cities, everything fueled Teg's disquiet. Mentat fashion, Teg felt the movement of forces around the keep and within it. His Gola charge was threatened. The order for him to report aboard the guild transport, prepared for violence, however, came from Terraza herself, with an unmistakable crypto-identifier on it. On the lighter taking him upward, Teg set himself for battle. Those preparations he could make had been made. Lucilla was warned. He felt confident about Lucilla. Shuangyu was another matter. He fully intended to discuss with Terraza a few essential changes in the Gamu keep. First, though, he had another battle to win. Teg had not the slightest doubt that he was entering combat. As his lighter moved into dock, Teg looked out a port and saw the gigantic Ixian symbol within the guild cartouche on the transport's dark side. This was a ship the guild had converted to Ixian mechanism, substituting machines for the traditional navigator. There would be Ixian technicians aboard to service the equipment. A genuine guild navigator would be there too. The guild had never quite learned to trust a machine, even while they paraded these converted transports as a message to Tleilaxu and Rakians. "You see, we do not absolutely require your melange." This was the announcement contained in that giant symbol of Ix on the spaceship's side. Teg felt a slight lurch of the docking grapples and took a deep, quieting breath. He felt as he always did just before battle, empty of all false dreams. This was a failure. The talking had failed, and now came the contest of blood, unless he could prevail in some other way. Combat these days was seldom a massive thing, but death was there nonetheless. That represented a more permanent kind of failure. "If we cannot adjust our differences peacefully, we are less than human." An attendant with the unmistakable signs of Ix in his speech guided Teg to the room where Terraza waited. All along the corridors and in the pneumotubes carrying him to Terraza, Teg looked for signs to confirm the secret warning in the Mother Superior's message. All seemed serene and ordinary, the attendant properly deferential toward the Basha.
"I was a Tireg commander at Andayoyu," the attendant said, naming one of the almost battles where Teg had prevailed.
They came to an ordinary oval hatch in the wall of an ordinary corridor. The hatch opened, and Teg entered a white-walled room of comfortable dimensions, sling chairs, low-side tables, glow-globes tuned to yellow. The hatch slid into its seals behind him with a solid thump, leaving his guide behind him in the corridor. A Bene Gesserit acolyte parted the gossamer hangings that concealed a passage on Teg's right. She nodded to him. He had been seen. Terraza would be notified.
Teg suppressed a trembling in his calf muscles. Violence? He had not misinterpreted Taraz's secret warning. Were his preparations adequate? There was a black sling chair at his left, a long table in front of it, and another chair at the end of the table. Teg went to this side of the room and waited with his back to the wall. The brown dust of Gamu still clung to his boot toes, he noted. Peculiar smell in the room. He sniffed. Sheer. Had Taraza and her people armed themselves against an Ixion probe? Teg had taken his usual sheer capsule before embarking on the lighter. Too much knowledge in his head that might be useful to an enemy. The fact that Taraza left the smell of sheer around her quarters had another implication. It was a statement to some observer whose presence she could not prevent. Taraza entered through the gossamer hangings. She appeared tired, he thought. He found this remarkable because the sisters were capable of concealing fatigue until almost ready to drop. Was she actually low in energy, or was this another gesture for hidden observers? Pausing just into the room, Taraza studied Teg. The Basha appeared much older than when she had last seen him, Taraza thought. Duty on Gamu was having its effect, but she found this reassuring. Teg was doing his job.
Your quick response is appreciated, Miles, she said.
Appreciated. Their agreed word for, we are being watched secretly by a dangerous foe. Teg nodded while his gaze went to the hangings where Taraza had entered. Taraza smiled and moved farther into the room. No signs of the mélange cycle in Teg, she observed. Teg's advanced years always raised the suspicion that he might resort to the leavening effect of the spice. Nothing about him revealed even the faintest hint of the mélange addiction that even the strongest sometimes turned to when they felt their end approaching. Teg wore his old uniform jacket of Supreme Basha, but without the gold starbursts at shoulder and collar. This was a signal she recognized. He said,
Remember how I earned this in your service? I have not failed you this time, either.
The eyes that studied her were level. No hint of judgment escaped them. His entire appearance spoke of quiet within, everything at variance with what she knew must be occurring in him at this moment. He awaited her signal.
Our Gola must be awakened at the first opportunity, she said.
She waved a hand to silence him as he started to respond.
I have seen Lucilla's reports, and I know he is too young. But we are required to act.
She spoke for the Watchers, he realized. Were her words to be believed?
I now give you the order to awaken him, she said.
And she flexed her left wrist in the confirmation gesture of their secret language. It was true. Teg glanced at the hangings that concealed the passage where Taraza had entered. Who was it listening there? He put his Mentat talents to the problem. There were missing pieces, but that did not stop him. A Mentat could work without certain pieces if he had enough to create a pattern. Sometimes the sketchiest outline was enough. It supplied the hidden shape, and then he could fit the missing pieces to complete a whole. Mentats seldom had all the data they might desire, but he was trained to sense patterns, to recognize systems and wholeness. Teg reminded himself now that he also had been trained in the ultimate military sense. You trained a recruit to train a weapon, to aim the weapon correctly. Taraza was aiming him. His assessment of their situation had been confirmed.
Desperate attempts will be made to kill or capture our Gola before you can awaken him, she said.
He recognized her tone, the coldly analytic offering of data to a Mentat. She saw that he was in Mentat mode then. The Mentat pattern search rolled through his mind. First, there was the Sisterhood's design for the Gola, largely unknown to him, but ranging somehow around the presence of a young female on Rakis who, so they said, could command worms. Idaho Golas, charming persona and with something else that had made the Tyrant and the Tlelaxu repeat him countless times, Duncans by the shipload. What service did this Gola provide that the Tyrant had not let him remain among the dead? And the Tlelaxu? They had decanted Duncan Idaho Golas from their axolotl tanks for millennia,
even after the death of the tyrant, that Relaxu had sold this Gola to the Sisterhood 12 times, and the Sisterhood had paid in the hardest currency, melange from their own precious stores. Why did the Tlaylaxu accept in payment something they produced so copiously? Obvious, to deplete the Sisterhood's supplies. A special form of greed there. The Tlaylaxu were buying supremacy. A power game. Teg focused on the quietly waiting Mother Superior.
The Tlaylaxu have been killing our Golas to control our timing, he said.
Terraza nodded but did not speak. So there was more. Once again he fell into Mentat mode. The Bene Gesserit were a valuable market for the Tlaylaxu melange, not the only source because there was always the trickle from Rakis, but valuable, yes, very valuable. It was not reasonable that the Tlaylaxu would alienate a valuable market unless they had a more valuable market standing ready. Who else had an interest in Bene Gesserit activities? The Ixians, without a doubt, but Ixians were not a good market for melange. The Ixian presence on this ship spoke of their independence. Since Ixians and fish speakers made common cause, the fish speakers could be set aside from this pattern quest. What great power or assemblage of powers in this universe possessed? Teg froze that thought as though he had applied the dive brakes in a thopter, letting his mind float free while he sorted other considerations. Not in this universe. The pattern took shape. Wealth. Gamu assumed a new role in his Mentat computations. Gamu had been gutted long ago by the Harkonnens, abandoned as a festering carcass which the Danians had restored. There was a time, though, when even Gamu's hopes were gone. Without hopes there had not even been dreams. Climbing from that cesspool, the population had employed only the basest pragmatism. If it works, it is good. Wealth. In his first survey of Gamu, he had noted the numbers of banking houses. They were even marked, some of them, as Bene Gesserit safe. Gamu served as the fulcrum for manipulation of enormous wealth. The bank he had visited to study its use as an emergency contact came back fully into his Mentat awareness. He had realized at once that the place did not confine itself to purely planetary business. It was a banker's bank. Not just wealth. But wealth. A prime pattern development did not come into Teg's mind, but he had enough for a testing projection. Wealth not of this universe. People from the scattering. All of this Mentat sorting had taken only a few seconds. Having reached a testing point, Teg set himself loose of muscle and nerve, glanced once at Terraza and strode across to the concealed entry. He noted that Terraza gave no sign of alarm at his movements. Whipping aside the hangings, Teg confronted a man almost as tall as himself, military-style clothing with crossed spears at the collar tabs. The face was heavy, the jaws wide. Green eyes. A look of surprised alertness, one hand poised above a pocket that bulged obviously with a weapon. Teg smiled at the man, let the hangings fall and returned to Terraza.
"We are being observed by people from the scattering," he said.
Terraza relaxed. Teg's performance had been memorable. The hangings swished aside. The tall stranger entered and stopped about 2 paces from Teg. A glacial expression of anger gripped his features.
"I warned you not to tell him."
The voice was a grating baritone with an accent new to Teg.
"And I warned you about the powers of this Mentat Basha," Terraza said.
A look of loathing flashed across her features. The man subsided, and a subtle look of fear came over his face.
"Honored Matre, I..."
"Don't you dare call me that!"
Terraza's body tensed in a fighting posture that Teg had never before seen her display. The man inclined his head slightly.
"Dear lady, you do not control the situation here. I must remind you that my orders..."
Teg had heard enough.
"Through me she does control here," he said. "Before coming here I set certain protective measures in motion. This,"
He glanced around him and returned his attention to the intruder, whose face now bore a wary expression.
"Is not a no-ship. Two of our no-ship monitors have you in their sights at this moment."
"You would not survive,"
the man barked. Tegg smiled amiably.
"No one on this ship would survive."
He clenched his jaw to key the nerve signal and activate the tiny pulse timer in his skull. It played its graphic signals against his visual centers.
"And you don't have much time in which to make a decision."
"Tell him how you knew to do this," Terraza said.
"The Mother Superior and I have our own private means of communication,"
Tegg said.
"But further than that, there was no need for her to warn me. Her summons was enough. The Mother Superior, on a guild transport at a time like this, impossible."
"Impass," the man growled.
"Perhaps," Tegg said, "but neither Guild nor Ix will risk a total and all-out attack by Bene Gesserit forces under the command of a leader trained by me. I refer to the Bashar Burzmali. Your support has just dissolved and vanished."
"I told him nothing of this," Terraza said. "You have just witnessed the performance of a Mentat Bashar, which I doubt could be equaled in your universe. Think of that if you consider going against Burzmali, a man trained by this Mentat."
The intruder looked from Terraza to Tegg and back to Terraza.
"This is the way out of our seeming impasse," Tegg said. "The Mother Superior Terraza and her entourage leave with me. You must decide immediately. Time is running out." "You're bluffing."
There was no force in the words. Tegg faced Terraza and bowed.
"It has been a great honor to serve you, Reverend Mother Superior. I bid you farewell."
"Perhaps death will not part us," Terraza said.
It was the traditional farewell of a reverend mother to a sister equal.
"Go!"
The heavy-featured man dashed to the corridor hatchway and flung it open, revealing two Ixian guards, looks of surprise on their faces. His voice hoarse, the man ordered,
"Take them to their lighter."
Still relaxed and calm, Tegg said,
"Summon your people, Mother Superior."
To the man standing at the hatchway, Tegg said,
"You value your own skin too much to be a good soldier. None of my people would have made such an error. There are true honored matres aboard this ship,"
the man grated.
"I am sworn to protect them."
Tegg grimaced and turned to where Terraza was leading her people from the adjoining room. Two reverend mothers and four acolytes. Tegg recognized one of the reverend mothers, Darwi O'Draid. He had seen her before only at a distance, but the oval face and lovely eyes were arresting. So like Lucilla.
"Do we have time for introductions?" Terraza asked.
"Of course, Mother Superior."
Tegg nodded and grasped the hand of each woman as Terraza presented them. As they left, Tegg turned to the uniformed stranger.
"One must always observe the niceties,"
Tegg said.
"Otherwise we are less than human."
Not until they were on the lighter, Terraza seated beside him and her entourage nearby, did Tegg ask the overriding question.
"How did they take you?"
The lighter was plunging planetward. The screen in front of Tegg showed that the Ix, branded guild ship, obeyed his command to remain in orbit until his party was safely behind its planetary defenses. Before Terraza could respond, O'Draid leaned across the aisle separating them and said,
"I have countermanded the Bashar's orders to destroy that guild ship, Mother."
Tegg swiveled his head sharply and glared at O'Draid.
"But they took you captive and—"
He scowled.
"How did you know I—"
"Miles!"
Terraza's voice conveyed overwhelming reproof. He grinned ruefully. Yes, she knew him almost as well as he knew himself. Better in some respects.
"They did not just capture us, Miles," Terraza said. "We allowed ourselves to be taken. Ostensibly, I was escorting Dar to Rakis. We left our no-ship at Junction and asked for the fastest guild transport. All of my council, including Burzmali, agreed that these intruders from the scattering would subvert the transport and take us to you, aiming to pick up all the pieces of the Gola project."
Tegg was aghast.
"The risk?"
"We knew you would rescue us," Terraza said. "Burzmali was standing by in case you failed.
That guild ship you've spared, Teg said, will summon assistance and attack our...
They will not attack Gamu, Terraza said. Too many diverse forces from the scattering are assembled on Gamu. They would not dare alienate so many.
I wish I were as certain of that as you appear to be, Teg said.
Be certain, Miles. Besides, there are other reasons for not destroying the guild ship. Ix and the guild have been caught taking sides. That's bad for business, and they need all of the business they can get.
Unless they have more important customers offering greater profits.
Ah, Miles, she spoke in a musing voice. What we latter-day Bene Gesserit really do is try to let matters achieve a calmer tone, a balance. You know this. Teg found this true, but he locked on one phrase, latter-day. The words conveyed a sense of summation at death. Before he could question this, Terraza continued, We like to settle the most passionate situations off the battlefield. I must admit we have the tyrant to thank for that attitude. I don't suppose you've ever thought of yourself as a product of the tyrant's conditioning, Miles, but you are. Teg accepted this without comment. It was a factor in the entire spread of human society. No Mentat could avoid it as a datum. That quality in you, Miles, drew us to you in the first place, Terraza said. You can be damnably frustrating at times, but we wouldn't have you any other way. By subtle revelations in tone and manner, Teg realized that Terraza was not speaking solely for his benefit, but was also directing her words at her entourage. Have you any idea, Miles, how maddening it is to hear you argue both sides of an issue with equal force? But your simpatico is a powerful weapon. How terrified some of our foes have been to find you confronting them where they had not the slightest suspicion you might appear. Teg allowed himself a tight smile. He glanced at the women seated across the aisle from them. Why was Terraza directing such words at this group? Darwi O'Draid appeared to be resting, head back, eyes closed. Several of the others were chatting among themselves. None of this was conclusive to Teg. Even Bene Gesserit acolytes could follow several trains of thought simultaneously. He returned his attention to Terraza. You really feel things the way the enemy feels them, Terraza said. That is what I mean. And of course, when you're in that mental frame, there is no enemy for you.
Yes, there is.
Don't mistake my words, Miles. We have never doubted your loyalty, but it is uncanny how you make us see things we have no other way of seeing. There are times when you are our eyes. Darwi O'Draid, Teg saw, had opened her eyes and was looking at him. She was a lovely woman. Something disturbing about her appearance. As with Lucilla, she reminded him of someone in his past. Before Teg could follow this thought, Terraza spoke. Has the Gola this ability to balance between opposing forces? She asked.
He could be a Mentat, Teg said.
He was a Mentat in one incarnation, Miles.
Do you really want him awakened so young?
It is necessary, Miles. Deadly necessary.
The failure of Chome? Quite simple. They ignore the fact that larger commercial powers wait at the edges of their activities. Powers that could swallow them the way a slig swallows garbage. This is the true threat of the scattering, to them and to us all. Bene Gesserit Council Notes, Archives, number SXX9OCH. O'Draid spared only part of her awareness to the conversation between Teg and Terraza. Their lighter was a small one, its passenger quarters cramped. It would use atmospherics to dampen its descent, she knew, and she prepared herself for the buffeting. The pilot would be sparing of their suspenses on such a craft, saving energy. She used these moments, as she used all such time now, to gird herself for the coming necessities. Time pressed. A special calendar drove her. She had looked at a calendar before leaving Chapter House, caught, as often happened to her, by the persistence of time and its language. Seconds, minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, years. Standard years, to be precise. Persistence was an inadequate word for the phenomenon. Inviolability was more like it. Tradition. Never disturb tradition.
She held the comparisons firmly in mind, the ancient flow of time imposed on planets that did not tick to the primitive human clock. A week was 7 days. 7. How powerful that number remained. Mystical. It was enshrined in the Orange Catholic Bible. The Lord made a world in 6 days, and on the 7th day he rested. Good for him, Odrade thought. We all should rest after great labours. Odrade turned her head slightly and looked across the aisle at Teg. He had no idea how many memories of him she possessed. She could mark how the years had treated that strong face. Teaching the Gola had drained his energies, she saw. That child in the Gamu keep must be a sponge, absorbing anything and everything around him. Miles Teg, do you know how we use you? She wondered. It was a thought that weakened her, but she allowed it to persist in her awareness almost with a feeling of defiance. How easy it would be to love that old man. Not as a mate, of course, but love, nonetheless. She could feel the bond tugging at her, and recognized it with the fine edge of her Bene Gesserit abilities. Love. Damnable love. Weakening love. Odrade had felt this tugging with the first mate she had been sent to seduce. Curious sensation. Her years of Bene Gesserit conditioning had made her wary of it. None of her proctors had allowed her the luxury of that unquestioning warmth, and she had learned in time the reasons behind such isolating care. But there she was, sent by the breeding mistresses, ordered to get that close to a single individual, to let him enter her. All of the clinical data lay there in her awareness, and she could read the sexual excitement in her partner even as she allowed it in herself. She had, after all, been carefully prepared for this role by men the breeding mistresses selected and conditioned with exquisite nicety for just such training. Odrade sighed and looked away from Teg, closing her eyes in remembrance. Training males never let their emotions reflect a bonding abandonment to their students. It was a necessary flaw in the sexual education. That first seduction upon which she had been sent, she had been quite unprepared for the melting ecstasy of a simultaneous orgasm, a mutuality and sharing as old as humankind. Older, and with powers capable of overwhelming the reason. The look on her male companion's face, the sweet kiss, his total abandonment of all self-protective reserves, unguarded and supremely vulnerable. No training male had ever done that. Desperately she grasped for the Bene Gesserit lessons. Through those lessons she saw the essence of this man on his face, felt that essence in her deepest fibres. For just an instant she permitted an equal response, experiencing a new height of ecstasy that none of her teachers had hinted might be attainable. For that instant, she understood what had happened to the Lady Jessica and the other Bene Gesserit failures. This feeling was love. Its power frightened her, as the breeding mistresses had known it would, and she fell back into the careful Bene Gesserit conditioning, allowing a mask of pleasure to take over the brief natural expression on her face, employing calculated caresses where natural caresses would have been easier, but less effective. The male responded as expected, stupidly. It helped to think of him as stupid. Her second seduction had been easier. She could still call up the features of that first one, though, doing it sometimes with a calloused sense of wonder. Sometimes his face came to her of itself, and for no reason she could identify immediately. With the other males she had been sent to breed, the memory markers were different. She had to hunt her past for the look of them. The sensory recordings of those experiences did not go as deep, not so with that first one. Such was the dangerous power of love. A look at the troubles this hidden force had caused the Bene Gesserit over the millennia. The Lady Jessica and her love for her Duke had been only one example among countless others. Love clouded reason. It diverted the sisters from their duties. Love could be tolerated only where it caused no immediate and obvious disruptions, or where it served the larger purposes of the Bene Gesserit. Otherwise it was to be avoided. Always, though, it remained an object of disquieting watchfulness. Odrade opened her eyes and glanced again at Teg and Terraza.
The Mother Superior had taken up a new subject. How irritating Teraz's voice could be at times. O'Drade closed her eyes and listened to the conversation, tied to those two voices by some link in her awareness that she could not avoid.
Very few people realize how much of the infrastructure in a civilization is dependency infrastructure, Teraza said. We have made quite a study of this.
Love is a dependency infrastructure, O'Drade thought.
Why had Teraza hit on this subject at this time?
The Mother Superior seldom did anything without deep motives.
Dependency infrastructure is a term that includes all things necessary for a human population to survive at existing or increased numbers, Teraza said.
Melange? Teg asked.
Of course. But most people look at the spice and say, how nice it is that we can have it and it can give us so much longer lives than were enjoyed by our ancestors.
Providing they can afford it.
Teg's voice had a bite in it, O'Drade noted.
As long as no single power controls all of the market, most people have enough, Teraza said.
I learned economics at my mother's knee, Teg said. Food, water, breathable air, living space not contaminated by poisons. There are many kinds of money, and the value changes according to the dependency.
As she listened to him, O'Drade almost nodded in agreement. His response was her own.
Don't belabor the obvious, Teraza. Get to your point. I want you to remember your mother's teachings very clearly, Teraza said. How mild her voice was suddenly.
Teraza's voice changed abruptly then, and she snapped,
Hydraulic despotism.
She does that shift of emphasis well, O'Drade thought.
Memory spewed up the data like a spigot suddenly opened full force.
Hydraulic despotism. Central control of an essential energy such as water, electricity, fuel, medicines, melange. Obey the central controlling power or the energy is shut off and you die. Teraza was talking once more.
There's another useful concept that I'm sure your mother taught you. The key log.
O'Drade was very curious now. Teraza was headed somewhere important with this conversation. Key log. A truly ancient concept from the days before suspensers, when lumbermen sent their fallen timber rushing down rivers to central mill sites. Sometimes the logs jammed up in the river, and an expert was brought in to find the one log, the key log, which would free the jam when removed. Teg, she knew, would have an intellectual understanding of the term, but she and Teraza could call up actual witnesses from other memories, see the explosion of broken bits of wood and water as a jam was released.
The tyrant was a key log, Teraza said. He created the jam, and he released it.
The lighter began trembling sharply as it took its first bite of Gamu's atmosphere. O'Drade felt the tightness of her restraining harness for a few seconds, then the craft's passage became steadier. Conversation stopped for this interval, then Teraza continued.
Beyond the so-called natural dependencies are some religions that have been created psychologically. Even physical necessities can have such an underground component.
A fact the Missionaria Protectiva understands quite well, Teg said.
Again, O'Drade heard that undercurrent of deep resentment in his voice. Teraza certainly must hear it too.
What was she doing? She could weaken Teg. Ah, yes, Teraza said. Our Missionaria Protectiva. Humans have such a powerful need that their own belief structure be the true belief. If it gives you pleasure or a sense of security, and if it is incorporated into your belief structure, what a powerful dependency that creates.
Again, Teraza fell silent while their lighter went through another atmospheric buffeting.
I wish he would use his suspensors, Teraza complained.
It saves fuel, Teg said. Less dependency.
Teraza chuckled.
Oh, yes, Miles. You know the lesson well. I see your mother's hand in it. Damn the dam when the child strikes out in a dangerous direction.
You think of me as a child? He asked.
I think of you as someone who has just had his first direct encounter with the machinations of the so-called Honored Matres.
So that's it,
Odraid thought. And with a feeling of shock, Odraid realized that Terraza was aiming her words at a broader target than just Teg.
She's talking to me.
These honored matres, as they call themselves, Terraza said, have combined sexual ecstasy and worship. I doubt that they have even guessed at the dangers. Odraid opened her eyes and looked across the aisle at the Mother Superior. Terraza's gaze was fixed intently on Teg, an unreadable expression except for the eyes which burned with the necessity for him to understand.
Dangers,
Terraza repeated. The great mass of humankind possesses an unmistakable unit identity. It can be one thing. It can act as a single organism.
So the tyrant said, Teg countered.
So the tyrant demonstrated. The group soul was his to manipulate. There are times, Miles, when survival demands that we commune with a soul. Souls, you know, are always seeking outlet.
Hasn't communing with souls gone out of style in our time?
Teg asked. Odraid did not like the bantering tone in his voice and noted that it aroused a matching anger in Terraza.
You think I talk about fashions in religion?
Terraza demanded, her high-pitched voice instantly harsh.
We both know religions can be created. I'm talking about these honored matres who ape some of our ways but have none of our deeper awareness. They dare place themselves at the center of worship.
A thing the Bene Gesserit always avoids, he said. My mother said that worshippers and the worshipped are united by the faith.
And they can be divided.
Odraid saw Teg suddenly fall into Mentat mode, an unfocused stare in his eyes, his features placid. She saw now part of what Terraza was doing.
The Mentat rides Roman, one foot on each steed. Each foot is based on a different reality as the pattern search hurtles him forward. He must ride different realities to a single goal.
Teg spoke in a Mentat's musing, unaccented voice.
Divided forces will battle for supremacy.
Terraza gave a sigh of pleasure, almost sensual in its natural venting.
Dependency infrastructure, Terraza said. These women from the scattering would control dividing forces, all of those forces trying mightily to take the lead. That military officer on the guild ship, when he spoke of his honored matres, spoke with both awe and hatred. I'm sure you heard it in his voice, Miles. I know how well your mother taught you.
I heard.
Teg was once more focused on Terraza, hanging on her every word, as was Odraid.